And then, of course, when we think of the Samsung debacle, like folks in leadership are obviously deeply concerned about having their source code go out to these servers
right.
where, you know, ChatGPT and things are actually running. And then it's just out in the ether and they're trained on it, right? And it's just gone, you know? So, well, it's not gone at all, actually. It can now be retrieved. So I think that folks in the C-suite are extremely concerned about it in that way. But at the same time, of course, there's a lot of productivity gains that can be had. And so, you know, a number of developers are just, you know, rapturous about not having to write unit tests. I've heard one of the most popular use cases tends to be for migration, right? And so again, I follow the JavaScript ecosystem. When frameworks change, it can be extremely tedious to have to update all of these different dependencies and, you know, some of the different class names and things. You know, they no longer have to do that.
Welcome to Software Snack Bites. I'm your host, Shomit Ghosh of Bold Start Ventures. And today we're excited to have James Governor and Kate Holterhoff on the show. James and Kate are analysts at Redbunk, the developer-focused analyst firm. And in this episode, we're going to cover evolving trends in developer tooling and the landscape today. So I think first to start things off, you know, James, I want you to give some context behind starting Redbunk, because I think it was 2002. Where the firm was
right in with the low blow. Yeah, we've been doing this for a while. And, you know, I think as much as anything else, we tracked as a company some of the fundamental shifts in how the industry has been constituted. So I think, you know, when we launched the firm, we're really one of the few, certainly advisory research firms in our kind of space. It was just so clear that open source was going to be absolutely fundamental to how software was built. The idea that you know, enterprises would not adopt that, or that it wouldn't be a significant part of the landscape, that was still happening. There were still people go, oh no, you know, this is not going to be an enterprise phenomenon. And it was just really obvious to us right then that it was. You know, other sort of mega trends, if we think about social, we jumped onto that really early. So, you know, blogging was something that was just very obviously a good conversational model for doing research, a great way of building community, punching above your weight. And obviously, then the cloud comes in. Cloud again, you've got this sort of skepticism. Oh, you know, what kind of adoption is this going to be? Is this just startups? You know, very clear to us that it was going to become part of the industry landscape. And I think if we tie all of that together, whilst we began the firm thinking, look, we need a company that is going to help people to understand the impacts of open source, as time went on, it really became clear to us that the phenomenon was really developer-driven tech adoption. Hmm. That open source was sort of an underpinning for that, but open source was not the thing. It was just part of the phenomenon. So one of the reasons that open source became so, you know, widely adopted was because developers found it so easy to get the bits. And if you make things easy for developers, you're going to get better results. So I think the industry has kind of moved that way. And yeah, I mean, we just felt that you know, further this open source thing, if you are trying to understand technology adoption purely through the lens of the purchaser, then you don't know what's going on. Like, yeah, fine, that was okay back in the olden days when we launched the firm. You know, you'd have 18-month dog and pony show, you know, deals on golf courses. You know, it was all about the salesperson in the room. That is just not how software is adopted today. Like, if you can't get the bits in people's hands, you're going to struggle.
Well, so Kate, what does analysis in this developer ecosystem look like? I mean, you could talk about developer experience, you could talk about integrations, you could talk about, there's just so many different things. So when you're analyzing a product or a group of products, like, how are you actually going about doing that in the developer ecosystem?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously the answer every analyst's going to give you is that it depends. But I think there's a few things that we look at, right? So, you know, what we tend to do is we frequent developer watering holes, right? So we spend a lot of time on Hacker News. We go to a lot of conferences and talk to developers, you know, in their happy place, right? Giving presentations about things that they're excited about, doing the hallway track, right? And then, of course, you know, we're spending time on Twitter and Reddit and focusing on these forums, you know, increasingly Discord, in order to see what they are actually excited about. So when we're thinking about developer experience, I think for us, it's really about trying to get an authentic sense of what developers actually are thinking. And, you know, lately I've been thinking a lot about the fact that developers are not a monolith, right? I talk a lot about upskilling, certifications, how, you know, folks are entering the space, the big reskilling move, right? If we think about the pandemic and all the folks who, you know, there was a great reshuffle in terms of where folks were working. You know, all of that kind of plays into the fact that there's a lot of folks who are joining the field and are, you know, having very different experiences from the sort of stereotypical grumpy sysadmin that tends to be particularly loud on places like Hacker News. And so, you know, when we think about what it means to actually reach developers, I think there's a lot of nuance there. And so the fact that we are just completely honed into what it is that developers are thinking, and when we are briefed by vendors, they're bringing us the developer's experience. You know, we always ask, how is it that developers actually like using your product? You know, give us a demo. What is the interface like? How does it, you know, integrate with their existing stack, right? How interoperable is it? And so, you know, we really are able to bring this perspective that I think is, you know, certainly unique to Red Monk, but also it really colors the way that we are thinking about developer experience as a firm, because it certainly is evolving, right? I mean, if, you know, we think back, Apple had a sort of DevX program in the 80s, right? So it's a longstanding, you know, way of thinking through, you know, how developers are going to interact with your products. But, you know, it wasn't until like 2013 that we started seeing this sort of like API driven economy and, you know, developer first mindset that now has really taken over and made the developer tooling industry so lucrative and exciting, and made developer experience just like absolutely essential to anyone who wants to succeed in this space.
Kate, I want to start with you on this, and then James, I want to hear your thoughts. Is I'll invoke another research fund in the space, Gartner, right? You have the Gartner hype cycle, and I think in developer tooling, right, we have these hype cycles. It was like container orchestration wars that was going on. I remember service meshes were like the biggest deal for a long time, right? Jamstack, which ironically now may actually be having its moment again, but like, when you're in those moments, what's the, like, cause there's so much promise that's why that those hype cycles are happening. But at the same time, there's all these like still challenges in adoption and who's using it and stuff like that. So how do you kind of diagnose what's going on in that moment?
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I think, when James mentioned the credibility thing, it's something that's certainly top of mind for us. Like, we don't want to just, you know, overemphasize the importance of something that is brand new, but at the same time, we want to follow it. And, you know, we're tech folks ourselves, we're geeks. We really get excited when new things are coming out. And so we follow them and share posts and, you know, read all the blogs that are really following it. And so, you know, so that's something that we endeavor to be measured and level headed, but, you know, to survive as an analyst, I think it's essential to keep, you know, abreast of the waves, still keeping the sort of nuanced glasses on. So I think maybe it's useful to kind of dig into one of those examples that you had. So, you know, I was a front end engineer. So Jamstack to me has been the one that I follow the most. And frankly, you know, I have been at Red Monk for 2 years. So for me, the hype cycle is a little less than James's. You'll forgive me. You know, so Jamstack is something that I have seen, even in my time there, really lose a lot of speed. And I think what's interesting about the Jamstack situation is that there, you know, as you noted, you know, there's already been a lot of movement in terms of like the excitement. So, and it really, I think, comes down to community in that particular case. So, you know, so Jamstack really, you know, it was coined in 2016 by Matt Billman. So he, you know, and it's this sort of architectural approach to sort of lay out what we're talking about with Jamstack. It's sort of, you know, it sounds punchy, but actually is an acronym for JavaScript APIs and Markdown. And so, you know, and it was really held up by Netlify. So it was one of those keywords that was made a thing by a particular vendor. And of course, there's a lot of problems associated with that. And then just recently, they decided, Netlify's decided that they are actually going to jettison the Jamstack for various reasons. I think most of it having to do with it just being overly complicated for most front-end developers. And they're now talking about the composable web. So fine, they sort of discontinued the Discord server. They got rid of the conference. You know, they sort of powered down. But then there's been folks who, like Zach Leatherman, who have said, actually, we like Jamstack. It was doing a lot of good work here. We're going to try to revive this term and take it away, you know, take it out of the context of Netlify and their sort of ecosystem and make it its own thing. Because it had, you know, a great following. I virtually attended the Jamstack conference. I mean, the number of sort of lights in the front end space that attended was, you know, remarkable. I mean, and it's interesting because it's positioned outside of, you know, Vercel. And of course, Vercel is taking up a lot of oxygen in the room in terms of front end. I'm sure we'll talk about them again later. But you know, Jamstack was doing a lot of really important work. And so there's been this new movement to sort of reframe what Jamstack can do. And I think it's a really great sort of way of thinking through the nuance there, instead of just saying like, Jamstack's over, Jamstack's dead, which actually is you know, I've seen that kind of thrown around. If you actually listen to the developers and what they think, they're saying, well, it's not dead. And the reason is that the community is so sort of forceful and vibrant that we're actually going to refocus the definition, and we're going to try to strengthen the community around these sort of new values that are no longer connected to just a single vendor. Like, we're going to try to make it a more robust space by bringing in more people.
That makes sense. Yeah. James, one question I have for you in this area is, you know, the container orchestration era, right? Like, we had these robust communities in like Mesos, Docker Swarm, you know, of course, then Kubernetes came in. I'm forgetting some of the others. There was, you know, even, you know, the chef's puppets of the world, like all these folks that were sort of in this space, they had vibrant communities, they had real use cases. Like, how do you go through the analysis of something like that when Kubernetes comes out or something? Like, is it, what are you looking for? What factors are you like looking for that, hey, this might be the thing that people start to adopt or whatever?
This is a great question. I mean, look, we're doing this for a while. And I mean, some of it is, you know, what are the maxims? I mean, it's like the future's already here. It's just unevenly distributed.
Right.
So William Gibson, I mean, it's not so hard to see the future. And again, much though I talked about the global implications of what is going on, I mean, you know, if you watch tools that people are getting super excited about south of market, chances are high that those sorts of approaches and tools are likely to find their way into the wider market. And then you start correlating that with just, as Kate mentioned, you know, there are platforms that we can get some data from. So, you know, when we do our programming language rankings, we use data from GitHub and Stack Overflow, do a scatter plot and try and understand, you know, what will be happening in terms of future usage through a snapshot, really, of the conversations and developer behaviors around particular programming languages or frameworks. You know, we're just so clear that Docker was just one of the most explosively growing technologies that we'd ever seen. It was obvious that containers was going to be a thing, right? So, you know, we'd seen sort of the OpenStacks and so on. And yeah, great. Okay. It, you know, had some telcos adopt it. We had the sort of the Cloud Foundry. Got some pretty good enterprise adoption. Pivotal did a pretty good job of basically training enterprises to do modern software development and then, you know, use Cloud Foundry. But Docker was just like right from the word go, it was cool. You know, GitHub itself, actually, like Git had been around for a while. People were kind of casting around being like, I think we need a new way to do version control because this centralized thing sucks. And Git was there and it was like, okay, but GitHub, when that came out, it was just very, very clear. If you spent time with developers and, you know, developers that do interesting work, then that was just going to be a game changer. And Docker was a bit like that. And I think, you know, some of what we do is we're like cool hunters. We're like the people that hang out in Shibuya and they're looking at what the kids are wearing and, you know, being like, okay, in you know, like 18 months, that is what they're going to be wearing in New York. There is an aspect of, you know, pattern matching. That's something that that all VCs do. But yeah, you look at the behaviors of people in the communities that you're interested in. You begin to trust some people that people with great radar. I mean, Jesus, it's just like, what a gift. So, you know, if you want to understand what's going to happen with LLMs, you spend time paying attention to what Simon Willison is saying, because he's doing the work and he is educating. And you know, the great thing for us as a company is we've never felt the need, like we package up things in a way that people can understand, but we've never felt the need to be like, oh, it's all us. It's hermetically sealed. You know, some other analyst companies would want to be like, this is our view and the world must fit into our view. We're much more interested in meeting people where they are and understanding their view, understanding their language, Jamstack or whatever it is. Yeah, sometimes Gartner defines the terminology. We end up talking about IDPs, internal developer platforms. And you're like, is that the best term? I don't know. But very often it's the market that decides. It's the developer conversation. That tends to be more fun. And yeah, we are in those developer conversations. I think we try and spot what's going to happen, continue those conversations, start to look for adoption, find what qualitative evidence that we can, and then you know, make those judgments. And yeah, that's, I think, what we've got a good track record on and people trust us with.
So I want to move into the impact that AI is having on developers. And, you know, you mentioned the language rankings, and one of the most interesting things from that post, which I read, we'll link to it in the show notes, but it's called What's Going On with Language Rankings. Mm-hmm. And one of the most interesting things from reading that was basically there seemed to be a clear impact of Copilot, not only on Stack Overflow, but also on GitHub itself and the data there. And so I guess where I want to start is sort of, I mean, what is going on with Copilot? Like, have we reached the promised land and, you know, all developers are going to be super productive and everything's going to be great? Like, what, you know, how do you explain this to folks who are thinking about, you know, is it a junior developer, is it a senior developer, is it the best thing since sliced bread? Like, what's going on?
A couple of things, but Kate is going to say something, but we need to be a little bit cautious about saying, well, the phenomena are driven by Copilot. Like, when you see things like that, you need to be causation and correlation. You need to be a little bit careful. There are some weird and interesting things. For me, the thing I was most weirded out by was the fact that, like, pull requests on projects are falling.
Yes.
That, to me, was like the, okay, that we need to drill into. And so we've got some things that you'll hear about. But I'm a bit cautious of saying, oh, everybody's using Copilot, so nobody's going to use Stack Overflow again. There are all sorts of things in Stack Overflow's business model, in you know, there are all sorts of things that we need to be a bit cautious about saying, oh, now we've moved over into the Nirvana and it's all done for those platforms. I'm very cautious of that.
Yeah.
But I think that Kate has an interesting take.
Well, I think we could just do like some level setting. So actually, James, I didn't look this up. How long has Red Monk been doing language rankings at this point?
I off the top of my head, I can't remember, but it's been a while.
It's been a while. Okay. Okay. Well, so, you know, I guess just to like, for folks who aren't going to read the article, you know, just worth noting that, so our colleague Rachel Stevens published this post, and, you know, she is, you know, spearheads a lot of our language rankings, which come out biannually and track, using Stack Overflow and GitHub, what sort of languages are the most popular. And it ends up being a really, sort of important, what?
Artifact for everybody.
Yeah, artifact. I like that. I was thinking deliverable and I was like, who are we delivering it to? But yes, so it gets a lot of traction on some of these dev watering holes I mentioned. So it's always, there's always that sort of Hacker News post associated with it. And usually Steve O'Grady, the other co-founder of Red Monk, hops on there to chat. So it ends up, you know, drawing a lot of eyes to what we're doing at Red Monk. So yes, when Rachel published this post just recently saying, hey, we're getting ready to come out with our newest set of rankings, and the data is really weird right now, and we are not sure what's going on. And so she has just started thinking through what could be causing this. And it seems like AI and some of these copilots is maybe related to this, but it doesn't explain everything, as James, you know, is mentioning here, that we're trying to be very cautious about trying to figure out what's going on here. And of course, it's always challenging with platforms, right? Because they give you a sort of glimpse into some of the data, but they don't always tell you everything, right? So I think we're trying to figure out whether or not continuing the language rankings in the way that we've been doing it for years is going to be feasible. And so that's the challenge, because the way that developers work right now, because of AI, because of AI code assistance, all of this is really upending a lot of things that we took for granted. But what we do know is that, yeah, the Stack Overflow has become less valuable to developers. It used to be the gold standard, right? This is where developers would go to do code snippets and to argue about the best way to accomplish something. And, you know, looking for terminology. I mean, I think everyone who has learned to code has spent a lot of time there, especially junior developers. And so it's a really important resource. But, you know, the question is it going to continue to be valuable as folks are more inclined to go onto ChatGPT and say, you know, ask their questions there? You know, there's a lot of value to having a sort of non-judgmental AI chatbot tell you the answer rather than going on Stack Overflow, which is sort of famously critical, especially of junior developers whose questions might not be, you know, the most sophisticated, right? So, you know, and a lot of that's kind of based on stereotypes of the space. And so I certainly don't want to necessarily perpetuate those. But I think that the idea of developers wanting a safe tool where they feel like they can learn in a non-judgmental way and at their own pace is invaluable. And so I think that's, you know, that nobody can argue with that, that ChatGPT provides that in ways that junior developers are finding particularly useful. And so, you know, how is that going to affect our language rankings? We're still working on figuring that out.
That pull request reduction is pretty interesting because like, even if, let's just say that my hypothesis, I'm not saying your guys' hypothesis, my hypothesis is that, you know, Copilot may have affected that. What I still don't understand is why would Copilot or anything, frankly, like, you're still going to have to merge and you're still going to have to like do code reviews and stuff. Like, so why would it go down?
So there are some interesting things. I mean, it's weird that lockdown correlated with irrational exuberance that from cloud companies, right? So on the one hand, you know, we're all living this. Well, actually, I didn't have a bad time. I mean, I got long COVID and that was bad.
Yeah.
That wasn't fun. But spending so much time with my family, epic. Like being able to like never have to travel and like just be home with my kids all the time was amazing. So that was great. But you remember the lives we were living? Any cloud service, whether, I mean, Netflix or whatever, was going to be getting an awful lot of use and adoption. And so GitHub was doing events where they were like talking about, oh, look, you know, people are doing, you know, and we've gone from the awful thing of like, you know, well, I think it's awful, but like, oh, it's my streak and I've developed every day for like the past 8 years and I'm going to keep on. I mean, it's like, you know, people sharing their tiles and stuff. Yeah, okay, but oh my goodness. But yeah, GitHub was finding that people were doing, were like, they were writing code much later in the day. And, you know, I'd be like, and I guess that's partly, oh, I've spent a lot of my time looking after my family or doing some of my other activities. And so, you know, now I'm doing those, you know, or weekend activities. Like, what are you, we couldn't go out. So what are you going to do? You're going to be like a Finnish software developer. You know, you're going to invent, you're going to invent Linux or invent MySQL or invent Varnish Cache or invent any of the other, you know, Nordic technologies that get invented when you're stuck in the ice, in the dark for months on end. You're more likely to just spend your time, if you're a developer, what are you going to do?
Right, you ship code. So then that makes sense. So you're saying it might actually be explained by, in fact, just literally you're lapping COVID still. Yeah, okay.
Give people their lives back. And, you know, funnily enough, they'll be like, oh, wait, there's other stuff I can do other than spending my time, as you say, slinging code. So, you know, I think some of it may be a return to normality. Then there are zero interest rate phenomenons.
Yep.
I mean, how many developers have been laid off? How many developers have been laid off in the past 18 months?
Right.
And if they were, if they were being paid in and around the job of writing software, you know, maybe they're working on their own projects. But in terms of development at scale, the kinds of thing that's going to make a meaningful impact on like pull requests on projects. It's possible, you know, fewer people with jobs writing software might just have an implication for activity on GitHub. So there's all sorts of weird possibilities, I think.
That's interesting because you're basically explaining, I think, unfortunately, like a bit of a Twitter filter bubble that at least I saw, which was everyone was retweeting it and being like, oh my God, it's the coming of AI. This is disrupting business models and everything. And you're like, wait a second. No, actually, you know, there's a lot of other factors that could impact this.
We're a bit cautious because honestly, even though, and you know, I talk about like, you know, Shibuya, I mean, for all the fact that ChatGPT immediately became, you know, like a hugely fast growing like consumer product. And, you know, that we have great stories. You know, my colleague Rachel, her mother had been looking for a new microwave that would fit a specific thing in a cabinet they had, and she wasn't going to pay the ridiculous $2,000 one. She tried Google a bunch of, kept trying and trying. What she heard about ChatGPT, she's like, here is a new search engine. Maybe I can find my microwave. So she found a microwave that could fit the thing. This is a consumer product, right? This is a product that anyone can use, but it is not today a tool that all developers have suddenly been like, I'm working in a 100% different way. That's filter bubble. It is definitely filter bubble to assume that like everyone is out there every day using, you know, like tools like Copilot and ChatGPT to write all their code. Cause that's just not, or to do the conversation that Cade is talking about. It is still early days for that. So
yeah.
Will it happen? 100%. But you know, has it happened? I think it's way too early to be like, oh, the future just happened and everything is done. And
yeah, we should check our biases at the door. And I think that's a good, even me asking that question, right? Now I'm like, okay, that's interesting. I should be thinking about it a little bit more. But, you know, Cade, I want to ask you a question because I think you've thought about this a decent amount. But what's sort of the downstream impact of in potentially the near term future, having a majority of our code being AI generated?
Yeah, well, it's something that I know a number of folks in leadership are worried about. But I mean, I think immediately it's going to be the amount of code that we produce and, you know, possibly low quality code. I mean, I think what's interesting about studying the code AI code generation space is that you see a lot of developers complaining about the bugginess of this code, right? That you want to treat these code assistants as like savvy interns or, you know, even folks in the junior developer role, which is a sort of problematic way of framing it. But you know, that it's something that needs to be reviewed. So the amount of code that is low quality that's coming out is something that I think a lot of folks are concerned about. And so when I say low quality, I mean that, you know, there's security risks, that it is, you know, calling APIs that don't exist, that it is, you know, maybe bringing in some insecure elements, right? So security is a big part of it. And then of course, when we think of the Samsung debacle, like folks in leadership are obviously deeply concerned about having their source code go out to these servers where these, you know, ChatGPT and things are actually running, and then it's just out in the ether and they're trained on it, right? And it's just gone, you know? So, well, it's not gone at all, actually. It can now be retrieved. So I think that folks in the C-suite are extremely concerned about it in that way. But at the same time, of course, there's a lot of productivity gains that can be had. And so, you know, a number of developers are just, you know, rapturous about not having to write unit tests. I've heard one of the most popular use cases tends to be for migration, right? And so, again, I follow the JavaScript ecosystem. When frameworks change, it can be extremely tedious to have to update all of these different dependencies and, you know, some of the different class names and things. You know, they no longer have to do that, right? Even just, you know, changing the templating language, right? You know, all of these things can be now automated. And I think that that's, you know, kind of contributes to a larger narrative of, you know, automation, right? And we could even bring in the, you know, I talk about buggy code, or even like black box solutions, right? That you can't see the code that you're bringing in. We have, low code and no code as, you know, part of this conversation, right? And this has been going on, for a while now. So AI is just sort of the newest way of giving folks that are in charge of these code bases anxiety, because it's like, now what are we dragging into this tenuous, ball of wax that I'm trying to keep together, right? You know, so how are, you know, we going to manage this new challenge is absolutely top of mind, but, you know, developers are tinkerers, right? They're excited to use it. And I think we're not going to say no to them, right? You know, that's I think a fool's errand. These new tools are here to stay, and they're doing great work, and they're going to improve. But it's, you know, something that everyone should be keeping their eye on, a very wary eye, right? The Air Canada, issue with their chatbot, you know, that one just cracked me up, because I love that the consumer got their money back at the end of the day, right? But, you know, chatbots are going to be promising things to customers that don't exist, right? Or that, you know, that now need to be honored, you know, based on this ruling. And so, you know, that's only just, you know, two sort of recent news reports about this. There are doubtless going to be, you know, hundreds in the future.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. And James, I want to ask you, another aspect of that is potentially we could have agents running around and, you know, running our infrastructure, or when I say running, I mean more like maintaining uptime or doing some of the debugging or stuff like that. I mean, how should we prepare for that world? Is that something we should be scared of? Like, is it going to happen anyway? Like, what are your thoughts there?
You know, I mean, I think like anything, there are two sides to it. And sort of Kate has talked about the amount of software that will be created that will all need to be maintained. I think one of the questions is, when do we throw it away? Because software becomes more situational. If I'm able to sort of scratch more itches, then there's going to be a lot more software. I mean, you know, to you as a VC, you're like, you know, for some of the people that you're talking to that are investable, instead of them having like the one thing they built, they might be like, well, I built these five things.
Oh, God.
And, you know, like, and they're all going to be pretty cool. And back to Simon Willison, he says that it used to be that one of his questions would be, hang on a minute, how long is it going to take me to learn that new thing, that library or that front end? You know, he's not a front end developer, so like to learn that front end thing, if I wanted to build something for my platform data set, like what would I need to learn to do it? Oh, you know what? I'd need to learn a lot, so I'm just going to keep on building core functionality. Now he'll play with something. He will use ChatGPT. He'll build something that's roughly functional. He'll be like, oh, I can kind of see how that works, and he'll improve it. And then, so now he says the longest thing he has is writing the blog posts about, you know, trying the new idea. Now I'm partly like, Simon, why don't you get the AI to write the blog post too? But, but so there's going to be a lot more software that, and as Kate says, that creates all sorts of challenges. The question about decision-making is super interesting, you know, we rely as a society on agents already, or algorithms. I mean, algorithms, you know, we live in a somewhat algorithmic world. It's becoming more algorithmic, and sometimes it's funny. Trying to get Gemini to, you know, come up with a white person. It's like, you know, when has it ever been a thing that white people were underrepresented? Like, and it's sort of funny, but it's also interesting. And you can be like, oh, ha, look, Google's so dumb. They over-rotated on wokeness. It's like, well, okay. But on the other hand, think about the experiences, the other experiences. And again, Rachel wrote a great piece. She wanted to use one of these headshot generators. And it's like a woman trying to generate a headshot which doesn't show cleavage is quite difficult. Mm. That's not cool.
Wow.
And so we are living in a world where there's going to be more of this. A lot of this stuff needs to be worked out because, I mean, we have to establish trust with the algorithms. As you say, in terms of developing, I mean, distributed software is non-deterministic. And distributed software with AI components is even more non-deterministic. And so that's going to create all sorts of challenges. Do you know what the good news is? We all get paid to solve challenges. We will have jobs. Like, we're not done yet. There are a bunch of things that need fixing. And there are going to be so many interesting things that need fixing. So, look, I'm half British and half American. So I'm like, some of the time I'm just a cynical asshole. That's the Brit. Other times I'm an optimistic asshole. That's the American. And so I'm like, you know, some of the time I'm like, oh, no, that'll never work. This is so terrible. Why are we doing this? And the other time I'm like, this is amazing. This is super exciting. This is like, so the truth is somewhere in between. And I think as long as there's work to be done, we'll be okay.
Well, we will certainly have lots to deal with. But one of the areas, and Kate, you recently had a post that you wrote. We'll link to it in the show notes. But it was on this front end workflow. We touched upon it briefly there, but it does seem like we're seeing, you know, at least I know it's not called Jamstack anymore. It's now component defined infrastructure, whatever framework defined infrastructure or something like that. But like it does seem we went from this wave. We hit the trough, and now it seems to be like, boom, back skyrocketing up again. What's driving that? What are you seeing on the front end side?
Yeah. So the front end space, I think, is deeply interesting. And so what I was always defending it from my soul. I was like, well, full stack is fine, I guess. But, you know, let's own the front end, right? In 2019, Chris Collier wrote a post called The Great Divide that really, I think, was this first movement of like, hey, we're front enders. It's okay. Like we're important too, right? And in the past couple of years, I think we're seeing a lot of vendors actually addressing front end buyers in this way that they hadn't in the past. And so I riffed on Stephen O'Grady's The New Kingmakers by writing a post about front enders being the new kingmakers for that reason, because they are driving a lot of buying decisions. And so, you know, I was the first post in a 3-part series. I will be talking a little bit about, you know, what the full stack pendulum and what that means, and a little bit about the history of you know, the front end and what all that means. But the, you know, the basic thesis is that we're seeing companies like Vercel talking about a front end cloud. Well, that's interesting, right? So we're not hiding behind full stack anymore. We're saying, yeah, no, we're here for the front end, right? We are going to support this particular group of developers. And again, I'm a big advocate of just not saying, hey, all developers are developers and they think the same way. It's like, let's think about different types of developers and different groups and communities within this profession. Okay. But then we also see backend as a service provider. So Supabase. They are catering to the Jamstack specifically. So Paul Copplestone, he was on the Changelog podcast and spoke just very clearly. Didn't miss a beat. Said, yeah, I'm targeting the Jamstack. And so to me, that is just fascinating because we have products like Firebase and Supabase and all these sort of backend as a service providers, you know, and a lot of times it's the database and all the services that surround the database. And, you know, front-end engineers don't necessarily want to fiddle with this. They mm-hmm. want to focus on things that excite them, which is the UI, right? And so now there's all these companies that are you know, recognizing this as like a huge demographic. And we can talk about why that would be. A lot of it has to do with, you know, new developers are front-end engineers first, and then they kind of migrate to the back-end. Or they're just excited by the space, right? I became a front-end developer because I have a background in design. So for me, it was a no-brainer. I was like, obviously, I'm going to be a front-end engineer because I want to be able to control the user's experience. That's what excites me. So we're seeing it not just be like this, you know, ashamed group of folks trying to center the div, like that's the, you know, folks hiding behind full stack so that they could get paid a living wage instead of being like, oh, anyone could write CSS. You know, people don't want to write CSS. You talk to backend engineers about CSS and they all go, oh God, I don't want to touch it, right?
They don't want to write it either, yeah.
You know, so this is a very important skill set and it's no easier than, you know, working in the backend. And frankly, there's a lot of money to be made there, right? Because if you are packaging services that are, you know, a managed service experience that does everything that the backend would do, you know, package it for front-end consumers, you know, that is a great market to be in. And so we're seeing a lot of vendors kind of recognize this and say, you know, the front end is kind of a cool place to be. And, you know, so in the post, I actually talk a little bit about like the identity associated with front end. You know, they tend to be more designers. So they tend to be to dress well. They carry themselves differently. And to pick on Vercel a little bit, they always wear the black t-shirts, right? And they're very cool. So there's just like a whole look around the front end that I think is worth, you know, being proud of, right? Like, the front end is not just like sad developers who aren't good enough to work in the back end. No, no, they're important to listen to for a number of reasons, and they've got their own identity, their own culture, right? They're doing cool things, and we should pay attention to what they're doing. And frankly, it's where a lot of the innovation is happening, right? Like, this is extremely important to the story around cloud. So, you know, I get excited about this, but yeah, I would say, you know, since 2019, the front end has been on the ascent. And we need, you know, folks who are just shrugging off front end as like, oh, you know, this is not an important part of the stack. You know, the top of the stack is not important. You know, our language rankings show that JavaScript is the absolutely mm-hmm. most popular language. It's extremely important, has been, you know, and front end is you know, a testament to that, right? And we need to be paying attention to that. And I certainly wanted to step up and say, hey, you know, I'm here for the front end. Let's pay attention to them. They're the new kingmakers.
I'm waiting I love that we're bringing power to the front end.
Absolutely.
Meanwhile, in my little community where I spend time in, like, we're talking about Zig and stuff like that. And so it's very interesting to have this dichotomy between, you know, what's exciting people on the back end and then what's exciting folks on the front end, which certainly is all this AI stuff that's coming out is really exciting a lot of folks on the front end side. So it's a fascinating sort of place. But you know, I want to move into one more topic, which I'd like to get your guys' viewpoint on, is open source licensing, right? We have all this sort of craziness that's happening. And you know, HashiCorp just made this.
Well, thanks for this question. This is just exactly. No, go ahead.
Like, how
you need to get Stephen O'Grady on. You need to get Stephen on. Stephen's the licensing guy.
Just very quickly, in terms of how you think about your viewpoint here, right? Like, HashiCorp making this change, some developers get mad. Some people are like, yeah, they need to make money. Where do you guys fall on this debate? What's your thought process here? Kind of share your viewpoints.
So, open source is the most successful and so far the best means of production for building software that the world has ever seen. The known and well understood restrictions have created and enabled an astounding amount of creativity and economic value. We are realists and we understand that you know, there can be a desire to pull the ladder up, to create a moat, and so on. I mean, you know, again, investors always want to know what your moat is, and perhaps the moat is, I'm just going to be polite. Yeah, so having a, you know, perhaps a shared source or a non-open source license. Now, there are some issues with this. In that it moves us back into a world of having to ask for permission, having to ask explicit permission to very often extremely powerful companies who weirdly may not have your best interest at heart. So, I mean, look, I understand that Meta only cares about people, right? And all they want to do is connect everybody. I get it. It's great. Lovely. But whether I should completely trust that the thing they called open, when I go and grow a business, remains open, and they're already writing it in. This idea that you can have a bit of success, but not too much, is a bit weird. And I think that it does create jagged edges. It does create a lot of paper cuts. It will make it harder to write software. Now, but look, I'm a realist. And so we can advise our clients, you know, and companies have good businesses. And I'm like, wait, what is it that you're, why do you need this other thing when actually you're being very successful? Well, the siren song, I get it. And we're realists, right? We have a view. We do think that open source licensing is good and you can build great businesses with it. But, you know, I also understand why people are feeling they need to make even more money and stuff, because that's capitalism. So, you know, people make bad decisions and we have to live with that. And it does get all more complicated with AI.
Right.
You know, models are not open source. Some of the code and the libraries around them are. And then, you know, this is where I am. I think in building businesses, you want certainty, and you can't be in a thing of like rug pulls. Mm-hmm. And when I see companies doing rug pulls because they used open source as a means to build a community, to get people excited, to maybe not write all the code, because different software companies work in different ways. Sometimes it's there are a lot of contributors from outside. Sometimes, very often, there are not. But the rug pull, I'm not fond of that, because if people have been excited and you've been part of this open source thing, and then one day they turn around and they're like, we're relicensing, it's not great. So I don't have any strong opinions about this.
Clearly.
I believe that the market will decide. Capitalism is great, and we can trust all corporations, and especially the big ones, because why would you not?
I think, that was a... a great rant to have and express our opinions. Just to wrap things up here, for each of you, what's coming up for Red Monk or a post that you're thinking about or whatever that that viewers should be excited about to check out. So maybe Kate, if we start with you.
Yeah, well, like I said, the front end newest new Kingmakers is a series, so. Going to follow up with two more pieces for that. And then I'd say, both James and I, all the analysts, we do a lot of our own sort of podcast work videos. So if you follow us on the Monkcast, you'll get to hear us sort of pontificate on a number of these subjects. And we've always got really interesting guests, usually developers, who are talking to us about what they think is exciting. And then, of course, I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter, and you can find me there. I'll pass to James.
Okay. Well, I'm currently working on a conference. Like, I haven't run it in like 4 years because of lockdown and some family stuff and everything else, but it's like my labor of love. The one in that Steve runs in Portland, Maine is in October. That's the Monktoberfest. Mm-hmm. So that's always worth checking out. It is the best conference apart from my conference, which is Monkey Gras, which is in London, coming up in March. And the theme this year, my theme changes a bit every year, is going to be about prompt engineering. Mm. Because your questions are right on the money. AI is super exciting, but also looking at the craft aspects of it, the craft of prompt engineering, the social aspects of it, some of the fear issues of it, the opportunity. So I'm just very excited about this AI change in the industry, because look, software development is a fascinating field. It's my life's work understanding it. And it continues to be fascinating. And there are all sorts of interesting areas, whether I'm looking at like progressive delivery, which is all the blue greens and feature flags and everything else on top of the pipelines. I think that getting better at writing software, that's so interesting to me. That's fascinating. But yeah, if we look at just that fundamental change, that disjunction when the cards sort of, flutter around a bit, and stuff is exciting, and you have to re-understand, reimagine the world, and dive in and help people understand it, which is what I like to do. AI is that. So yeah, I'm as excited about the opportunities at the moment as I've ever been, and that's a pretty good place to be. And yeah, so just continue to work. So yeah, engage with us if you're interested in the intersection of software delivery, AI, cloud, developer experience. That's what we're all about. And it's good times.
Well, on that note, we will end things. I think we have the optimistic side coming out to end the podcast here, which is great. Thank you both so much for the time, and we'll link to all of the content that your team puts out. Thank you for putting that out for the rest of us, because we all enjoy it. It certainly captures the zeitgeist of all of us. And I think also, as we have determined in this podcast, sometimes even sheds light on some of our biases that we bring to bear, even when you guys publish something simple in terms of what you're just trying to call out, but then pulls it forward. So really appreciate it, and keep up the great work.